then of course men get rewarded more than women. But then you have even like people who try to genuinely help women are telling them, oh, be more confident,
right.
You know, just believe in yourself. Don't worry about what people think of you. Just, you know, there women are asked to emulate not just men, but incompetent men, the incompetent men that fail upwards. And of course, you know, I want to help women to get to the top, but if our the means or the strategies or the tactics that we recommend to help them perpetuate a system that is biased and flawed and that doesn't improve the quality of the leaders, it's not the right women that will get to the top. And also, in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of incompetent men who remain in the top because they are experts in these kind of overconfident behaviors.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Thomas Camerlo, an internationally renowned psychologist whose work focuses on people analytics, talent management, and leadership development. He's currently the chief talent scientist at Manpower Group and professor of business psychology at University College London and Columbia University. In this episode, Thomas gave us an inside look into his new book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders? He discusses the dangers of choosing confident leaders, how to value substance over style, and how we need to change what we look for in leaders. Here's our conversation. Well, thank you, Thomas, for joining me this morning. I'm really excited to have you, your thought to be shared with our listener. And what really drawn me to have you on our podcast is that you use science and technology to help predict human performance. And one of the things also caught my eyes on your most recent book is about your title is Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders? And how to fix it. And so we have a lot to talk about. So shall we start?
Sure. Thank you for having me.
So there's so many things that I have, from your book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders? And what are the things that somehow make them the leaders or appointed leaders?
Well, you know, I guess the simple answer is that they are somehow chosen or managed to emerge. And, you know, what the book tries to highlight is that that is mostly because of our tendency to be seduced with some of the qualities that they display and our inability to distinguish between confidence and competence. You know, more and more, especially with the world becoming more complex and the nature or essence of leadership qualities being more elusive, more changeable, and harder to judge or pinpoint in simple, brief interactions, such as a job interview or a presidential televised debate, we cling to what we see. And even though it's quite straightforward to see whether someone comes across as likable, charismatic, confident, and sometimes even a bit narcissistic, those are the very qualities that you actually want to avoid when you select leaders, you know? So I think the big lesson, for example, of this pandemic has been that boring leaders are tremendously underrated, and that when you have a crisis or are dealing with some difficulties or a health epidemic, it's not that important to have funny, entertaining, or charismatic leaders. What you want is someone who is rational, decent, and has other people's best interests at heart. You know, so in a way, there's that prophetic element in the book, even though it was written before the pandemic, that actually predicted quite a lot of the things we have seen in the past year and a half.
So you're saying that, you know, for example, the charismatic, the entertaining, the likable, and oftentimes, when I put aside like a president's, like, you know, because it's like I'm voting by, you know, population. Well, in this country, electoral vote, but like in a company context, human is still human, right? They still like to work with the people they like, that inspire them. And how do you create that discipline in, so that they choose the right leader rather than...
Well, the only way to improve things and create that discipline is to develop the necessary skills or expertise to actually focus on substance and not on style. And to be absolutely clear, you know, traits like charisma aren't detrimental per se. I think, you know, if you're an ethical and competent leader, sure, I want you to be as charismatic as possible so that you can influence others, persuade them to come along and, you know, really exercise what I think is the essence of leadership, which is to convince a group of people to collaborate for the common good or a common objective that the team or organization might have. But the dangers come when you're not competent, when you're not ethical and you have charisma, because then, you know, it can make you quite toxic and destructive as a leader. Equally, when it comes to confidence, what most people don't realize is that the relationship between confidence, so how good you think you are at something, and competence, how good you actually are, is very low. You know, there's like 9% overlap between the two. So a lot of the times, if we focus a lot on picking people based on their confidence, we're going to end up with incompetent people in charge. And also, we're going to dismiss or overlook a lot of people who are really good, seriously talented, hardworking, but just not very full of themselves, not unjustifiably pleased with themselves. And it's ironic that especially in this country, in the United States, we have somehow concluded that when people are aware of their limitations, that's a liability as opposed to a strength. And when someone seems utterly incapable of understanding their limitations or knowing what they don't know, they actually impress us. You know, and I think now we realize at least conceptually that that's a mistake, but we keep on making the mistakes in practice. So if someone talks a lot in an interview, we go like, wow, they must surely know what they're saying, as opposed to actually pausing and thinking whether they're saying anything reasonable. And if someone puts themselves forward for a job, we assume that they have leadership potential. Maybe they just want power and status. And equally, if someone isn't busy self-promoting, self-branding, or advertising themselves, we point the finger at them and we're saying, oh, if only they were more confident or they could lean in. Usually that's women, not men. When in fact, the real problem is not that competent people don't lean in, but that we keep on falling for people who lean in when they're not competent.
Right. And I think it's interesting you're saying that about, you know, I came from different culture, different country growing up. I grew up in Indonesia. I think what I learned when I first came to this country is that exuding confidence is so important. And I, my boss, when I used to work in Switzerland, he told me when I got resume from American, European, and Asian, I have to gauge it differently. And of course, this is from his perspective. He was saying that if I got a resume from American, I need to discount it. If I got a resume from the Asian, I need to upgrade it. And if I got the European, it's just about right. But of course, that's him from the European side. But like, in a way, we are, I'm seeing a lot more of this American confidence also being exported now because everybody wants to learn like, well, I want to be more American. I definitely see it the next generation in Asia where they try to emulate to be more like American, show your confidence without the competence.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're highlighting, I think, some widely known cultural differences. Some are stereotypes, but often stereotypes are based on, you know, real differences. I mean, you know, today we probably, most of us forgot what traveling actually meant. But for anyone, and I'm sure our listeners have traveled widely, you have to be pretty insensitive to cultural differences to not realize that when you go from Indonesia to America, or even from America to Canada or the UK, there are these differences, right? And I think you're right. You know, America is still the dominant superpower. And, since the 1980s with the advent of mass media and television and Ronald Reagan, you know, there was this narrative or this approach to, oh, just believe in yourself, be confident, whatever, etc. You know, I used to say half jokingly that maybe it's now an American strategy to halt or stop the rise of Asia, to make them as narcissistic and self-confident as they are in LA or California, and then maybe they can become complacent or deluded before they keep working hard and they're self-critical. It would be a real shame, you know, because I think if you go back to the US or you think about here, we've been now lamenting the fact that our leaders are not humble, that they don't have integrity, that they don't have curiosity, that they're not coachable for at least 20 years. And that's because when we choose them, they look a lot like, I don't know, Leonardo DiCaprio's character in The Wolf of Wall Street, and not so much like the leaders we really need. I mean, just look at now, not to make a political point, but if you think that now we spend a month or so with a president who isn't on TV every day or making jokes or making fun of others every day. And, you know, let's face it, he doesn't seem to be spectacular, but he's pretty boring. And that seems to most people like a massive upgrade from someone who was just a chief entertainer officer and often not that entertaining, especially when you have a pandemic, you know. So I think, you know, I understand that humans are fascinated with charisma and the dark side of leadership, but when you choose your boss, or if you have a choice over who your president is or head of state, it's really important that they're competent, that they're kind, and that they are honest. And the rest is detail, you know. So I think it's a shame that in today's world, all style and no substance will get you further in life than no style and all substance. And that's something we need to change. And that's basically the message of the book. We need to look at ourselves in the mirror and question our ability to select leaders in business, in healthcare, and in public leadership.
Do you think, because if you want to change, to choose the leaders that is competent, that's a harder, you have to listen, you have to observe more, because somebody who's entertaining and likable is just, I always say that it's easy to see when somebody jumps. But you don't pay attention when somebody just walk.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, it's because the world has become more complex. And today, you know, I mean, if you think about something like the knowledge economy and knowledge workers, you know, most of us operate at a very abstract and conceptual level, right? So, you know, you and I don't know each other very well. We can spend some time looking at each other's profile on the internet and, you know, conclude that we have some qualifications or not. But if we were meeting, sitting next to each other on a plane, or this was a conversation, it would be very difficult for me to assess what your level of expertise or competence is, and vice versa, right? But what's easy is to look at whether we seem assertive, whether we speak clearly, and, you know, and so a lot of the times, there are deception strategies that will distort our judgments of competence, of other people's competence. So that's why we cling to what we see, which is style. And, you know, the human brain is, in essence, not optimized for thinking. I mean, we try to make everything as predictable and simple as possible. So I don't want to have to waste a lot of time assessing what you say and fact-checking, etc. And for 99% of our evolutionary history, in a few minutes, you could tell whether someone knew what they were saying or not, because life was simple. You lived only with the same group of people, 10 or 20 people, all your life. So you knew them very well. It's a bit like when you are with your close friends. You can tell if they are, you know, bullshitting you or not.
Right.
You know? So, but now it's very difficult. Voters are asked to make these inferences and make these evaluations based on very limited data, like a presidential debate. So you can't blame them for the fact that they pick a president based on who they would rather have a beer with. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, since the 1960s, actually, when JFK beat Nixon, because Nixon was sweaty and JFK looked good and he had a great suit, you know, maybe he was the better candidate, but we look for shortcuts. Right. And there's a wonderful kind of explanation that evolutionary psychologists came up with, which is that basically, as our abilities to judge talent have improved over the course of our human evolutionary history, our abilities to deceive others have improved in turn. You know, so it's a bit like a cat and mouse fight or game where if I know, for example, that you're paying attention to whether I do eye contact, whether I'm confident and, you know, whether I smile, etc., I'm going to do these things and deceive you. And by the way, one of the easiest ways to deceive others is to deceive yourself first. So if I'm narcissistic and deluded, I will come across as very secure, confident, and charismatic in an interview, mostly because I'm just not aware of my limitations.
Right. And then the more you do it, the better you are at it. And then it make it harder for the other person who never met you to.
Exactly. And I get rewarded for it. And of course, men get rewarded more than women. But then you have even like people who try to genuinely help women are telling them, oh, be more confident.
Right.
You know, just believe in yourself. Don't worry about what people think of you. Just, you know. There, women are asked to emulate not just men, but incompetent men, the incompetent men that fail upwards. And of course, you know, I want to help women to get to the top. But if our the means or the strategies or the tactics that we recommend to help them perpetuate a system that is biased and flawed and that doesn't improve the quality of the leaders, it's not the right women that will get to the top. And also, in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of incompetent men who remain in the top because they are experts in these kind of overconfident behaviors.
It's almost like the chicken and egg, like the system is there. And then so you reward more of these kind of behavior, right? And one of the things somebody told me before, Christine, because I would say my work would show me whether I did a good job or not. And my work would speak for itself. And somebody was telling me, no, your work cannot speak for itself. You have to speak on behalf of your work. And it's, you know, I think some people tend to speak more about their work without their work. But then because they marketed their work so much that people believe what they say and they don't see what they do. And it's easier, right? So how, as a leader, you know, if you're CEO of the company, because you need to know who is your value employee versus somebody who knows how to say the right thing but don't get things done, but somehow you believe they got it done because you believe what they say.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I guess 2 points. The first is that in a logical or, you know, fully rational world in which everyone operated within a meritocratic or rational system where, you know, let's say a very talent-centric system where you really get rewarded for what you produce and people can see what you deliver. Sure, you know, it's lovely to think about a situation where most people can say, oh, I just let my achievements speak for themselves and that's it. Realistically, unless you are, you know, Serena Williams or Vincent van Gogh, you just can't say that. And even Van Gogh died in utter poverty, you know? So I think, you know, the reality is that if you're going to stay quiet and keep working and hope that people notice your achievements and that they speak for themselves, you probably will be overlooked. And, you know, it's unfair, but you will lose to people who spend a lot of time on self-promotion, etc. But that is the vicious cycle, that if then we teach everyone to self-promote and we create, you know, a nation or an army of imposters or people who just speak, talk, and no one is working, that's also bad. That's bad for the system. And then I guess the second point I would make is that, you know, we often focus too much when we look at these type of career tips or advice, et cetera, whether for men or women, the focus tends to be too individualistic, you know? And so, yeah, from an individual standpoint, if I'm trying to help you as a person get to the top, I should probably coach you to adapt to the system as it is. But the moral imperative and the responsibility that we should have or should feel is to actually improve the system. You know, so, and of course, when the system works and people trust each other and there aren't too many people bending the rules or taking shortcuts, you always open the door to some people to have more kind of imposter or free rider effects on the system. But if you keep it low, the system can function, you know. To go back to the kind of cultural analogies, I grew up in Argentina where we actually make it, it's part of our cultural DNA. We call it viveza criolla or viveza porteña, to find the way, you know, to be streetwise and bend the rules. So, you know, so if you pay taxes and you tell people that you're working hard and, you know, you're plodding away, et cetera, you will be ostracized or downgraded by your group of friends because you're an idiot in essence, right? Is that the other extreme of maybe Singapore, right? Where, what do you mean? You're supposed to follow rules and you believe in the system and things that, so it's interesting because, you know, maybe you can import 5 or 10 Argentines to Singapore and Singapore will continue working and they will get, you know, fat without working very hard. But at the end of the day, what we judge is whether the healthy versus unhealthy imbalance or balance in a system makes the collective, the organism or a society prosper or not, you know? Right. So I think basically we don't realize this, but a lot of the advice that we give people are just designed to make them more Machiavellian, more ruthless and operate within a system that is corrupt. And what we should be doing instead is to, you know, fight or combat corruption so that we have a fair system in place that is more meritocratic.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rutnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
Through our work, we work with a lot with early, you know, early stage young entrepreneur. They can make a difference in their organization. And I think that's why, you know, one of the things that I'm excited to have you to share your insight is so that they can learn like how to avoid to create that kind of culture, to create that kind of system in their organization. Because you do want to have competent people rather than overconfident but not competent. And what would you say to those CEO? Because they also have to lead by example. Because they might have certain...
Well, so first of all, you know, I think entrepreneurship in a way is already a reaction or a byproduct of some of these problems that that I highlighted, right? I mean, the fact that a lot of people are pushed into entrepreneurship, not pulled, but pushed because they're just fed up with being overlooked at work and, you know, not having their potential harnessed or developed or not even having their talents understood. So the typical entrepreneur in industrialized economies and highly functioning economies, rich countries like the US, is just fed up with either big corporations, bad leadership, etc. So, you know, they feel the urge to create something better. And if you look even at the phenomenon of female entrepreneurship, it's that on steroids, because the typical successful female founder, and it's very difficult to achieve this, would have been overlooked for leadership roles in the previous employer and would have stumbled upon the glass ceiling and would have been fed up with either not having their talents appreciated or being discriminated against, et cetera. So then they end up succeeding doing something much harder, which is to create something from scratch and competing against not just the previous employer, but the industry and disrupting it, you know? So I think with that comes an important reminder, which is most people think that entrepreneurship is about having a great idea and selling it and, you know, really being very driven and maybe even having a healthy degree of reality distortion so that you can see the world in different ways and persuade others that you're right. But actually, leadership is one of the fundamental qualities that distinguishes between successful entrepreneurs and those who are not. And in a lot of cases, having the awareness that you're not a natural leader and teaming up with someone who has leadership skills is the best thing that you can do as an entrepreneur. So, you know, we have so many cases in history where one of the founders is an ideas person and solves important problems or has a technical expertise. And then the co-founder is a people person and understands how to manage others. And there's a reason why, even if you look at big tech today, the founders at some point take a step back and bring people with leadership skills or track record to the table. You know, so the idea is maybe 5% of the process, the execution and the planning and raising capital, etc., is maybe 45%, but the remaining 50% is leadership. Do you have the qualities, the vision, the competence, and the integrity to persuade a group of people to collaborate effectively and build something new?
Right. So some people, like you're saying, they have the technical leadership, and then they later team up with somebody with more the people person. And some people can grow to do both, right? And what are the things? Because oftentimes when a startup just started, the founder's passion is so important. And then as they grow, you bring more people. But then before they get there, they still need to manage the team. They still need to manage the group. What are the advice for people who are very technical, but they still have to be there until they get to a certain stage before they bring somebody who have the known leadership skills?
Yeah, you know, I mean, my main advice is to really work on yourself and develop your own, you know, soft skills, which is now sort of a term or a label that is becoming passé because everyone understands how important soft skills are. So, you know, some of my colleagues are calling them universal skills or power skills. So, you know, you can for sure work on them. Just like if you said, okay, I want to run a marathon, it doesn't matter how fit you are, naturally speaking, or to begin with, you know, with the right training, the right diet, the right discipline, you can get there, right? So, or if you want to learn a language or to play a musical instrument, anyone can do this. So I think you need to have the will, you know, the willpower to actually do it. You need to have the humility to understand that you might not be great naturally and you might need to work on it. You need to have the curiosity to actually get feedback from others, learn about yourselves and understand how to get better. With that, you can really do it. And, you know, I see more and more activity in the area of coaching or developing leadership skills for entrepreneurs. By the way, also private equity companies, investment funds, venture capitalists, angel investors, etc., are now understanding that the idea, the business plan, the PowerPoint deck is an important part. They still see it as the most important part of the potential, but actually the team, the dynamics, and the personality of the founders or of the leadership team are at least as important. Right. And, you know, so I think we can all find better ways to lead and we can all find ways to be a better version of ourselves, which is what this is about. And I always say, you know, great leaders are always a work in progress. They weren't born and they're never a finished product. You need to keep working on it. And, you know, in reality, that's the means, the resources, the time and the conditions that you need to do it are not necessarily smaller or less when you are a founder or an entrepreneur or running a small business than when you're in a big business. Typically mm-hmm. in big corporations, you know, they coach or develop a very small number of leaders. And actually one of the paradoxes in coaching and leadership development is that it tends to focus on those who need it the least because those who really need it opt out or, you know, decide not to get it. And even if they got it, they would not respond very much, you know? So coachability, I think, is a really important overlooked quality of entrepreneurship. Can you get better? And how much can you develop and improve your leadership potential?
And I think that relates to the confidence, right? If you're very confident about, you tend to think that you know it all. I remember when I first came here, I met somebody who found out that I also speak Mandarin. And I said, oh, how well do you speak your Mandarin? I said, oh, I'm fluent. And I thought, so I started speaking to them. And I was like, that's not fluent. Again, it's how do you, as an entrepreneur or as a leader, how do you check, make sure that you have enough confidence, but not over?
Yeah, you know, and I think the you need to have the tricky part and the key ingredient is you need to have that kind of baseline to measure your actual competence or performance. And typically, you know, there is no objective test for doing that. So actually getting feedback from people who are experts or who have seniority or who have power or who can influence things, finding a good mentor, someone who will actually give you honest, critical feedback, is the only way. And asking the question, you know, people don't ask others for critical, helpful, negative feedback enough because it makes us uncomfortable, you know. So from a very early day, age or stage when we are in school and then college, we ask questions that are leading questions designed to capture positive feedback. Was this okay? Did you like it? Was my paper great? Or, you know, wasn't this a good presentation? And of course, because we live in a civilized and polite society, one of the qualities or characteristics of living in a world that is nice and not as brutal as it was in medieval times is that we reinforce this because we show empathy and feel sorry for others, which is why, you know, leaders or managers who can show a bit of tough love and be honest and provide critical feedback are so important. I think anyone, if they think back at important career-turning moments in their lives, they can find or remember a case when someone told them something about their potential or their talent that they didn't like, that might end up or that probably ended up being eye-opening and had a fantastic, you know, developmental effect on them, you know, like you realize you talk too much or you realize that you interrupt a lot or did you realize that actually your Mandarin isn't that good? These are very helpful, critical incidents because we live in a world where we don't get enough critical feedback from others. By the way, this is why, you know, you have people like Ray Dalio and Bridgewater and others that are implementing cultures of radical transparency and being brutally honest. This is very extreme and it doesn't work for most people because it's too, you know, too kick-ass. It's like a punch in the face. But I think there is a moderate middle. And, you know, so if you're an entrepreneur and you're starting from scratch or you're creating a culture, I think creating the conditions of psychological safety where it is okay for people to solicit and get negative feedback, especially if you're a leader, ask your direct reports, your subordinates, your employees to critique you and help you get better and hope that they actually do it because they're not afraid. You know, I remember we did some studies 10 years ago. We went into large organizations and asked people, it was like a self-report survey. And one of the questions was, or statements, I frequently provide my direct boss or direct line manager with negative feedback on their performance. Only 5% of people said yes. And probably half of them were about to get fired or lied, you know. But actually, that's exactly what you need. If you're a boss, there can be no better gift than one of your employees to tell you, you know what, I don't agree with what you did. And you can make it easier by asking them, if you were in my shoes, what would you have done differently? What are two things that you didn't like about my performance, my presentation? And then you create this culture of feedback. If this worked and this was the norm, we wouldn't need 360-degree feedback surveys or assessments or an independent consultant to come and tell you that your employees don't like you, you know? but that's the reality.
Yeah, I think it's, and all you're saying is also we are not in a medieval, and also the culture I mean, you can see a lot more, you know, now I raise my son here in the US is about positive feedback because it's so important to keep their confidence up. Where I came from, where I grew up, the only praise I got is negative praise. Because why do I need to tell you if everything is great? Because there's nothing you need to improve. So that's the other extreme. And it's almost like as a leader, you need to have that sense of security that you don't know everything.
Yeah.
There's something that...
I think, and also to be absolutely clear, nobody wants to create, a state of pathological insecurity in others, whether they're your children or your employees, so that they're traumatized and, riddled with self-doubt and they're so anxious or insecure that they don't even want to try things. We don't want to do that, right? But it's equally bad to foster or instill a state of extreme delusion where, if you grow up with your parents and your school teachers and your relatives and all your friends telling you that you're amazing, and at some point you hit the real world and other people who are not as conflicted need to look at you, you'll end up a lot like those people, the early round contestants in America's Got Talent or The X Factor, who stand up and sing. And you can see they think they are Beyonce or Pavarotti, but actually they sound like a strangled cat. And, there's a reason why we laugh at them is because you can see this huge gap or mismatch between their confidence and their competence. And that's something that you want to avoid. Now, it turns out that when the skills are not singing skills, but leadership skills, it's a lot harder for us to distinguish between what's style and what's substance. But, when you have a pandemic, you can tell, the difference between an Angela Merkel and a Bolsonaro, for example. And so, so I think we just need to be very serious about our evaluations of talent in every area. And I mean, even entrepreneurship is such an interesting case study because to this day, people argue as to whether Elon Musk is a crazy, narcissistic charlatan or the biggest genius of innovation of modern times. And what we know is that the market believes in him, but still, by rational standards, I think somebody made the calculation the other day that to justify the market cap Tesla has, each car would need to be sold at like $1.2 million, which isn't ever going to happen, So, I think, and then again, because you could say the same about Steve Jobs and, these people are arguably quite narcissistic and overconfident, but they do have talents that 99% of people don't have. Right. If you think you can wear a turtleneck and stand up and give an amazing presentation and people are going to see you as Steve Jobs, think again, because that's maybe only true in the imagination of your parents and yours.
Yeah. And I almost think that also the media attract to that kind of story because it's shiny, it's controversial, and it's almost like we need to make not just the system, but everybody to understand, to value people competency rather than just about drama.
Yes, it's always easy to kind of blame the media. And, sometimes, if you look at the traditional media, so I live in New York, which was, as you know, badly hit, especially in the early stages of the pandemic. And, not to speak about my own talents for understanding competence or whatever, but it was pretty shocking to me that at the time of this state performing really, really poorly health-wise and it's dealing with the crisis, our governor Cuomo had 95% approval ratings and was celebrating for his great PowerPoint presentations, in essence, and it's like, I understand that maybe a lot of the things that are happening are not his fault, but clearly there's not much to celebrate. Now, of course, every day the media, except CNN, because his brother works there, has a new story on, this guy is like the biggest sexual predator in history, etc. So the media likes these all or nothing, black or white, sensational accounts of things. And if someone is low-key and dealing with situation well, we probably don't cover them very much. What's more worrying, I think, is that today the temptation to, if you're young, and you know, the temptation to become famous for the sake of being famous and be a TikTok sensation or Instagram influencer, etc., is very high. And you know, if the only way or the only measure of your worth or value is how many people follow you or how many people retweet you or how many people you know, celebrate your narcissism, I think there is a cultural problem. I would say we've always admired famous people, but in the old days or historically, you needed to have a skill to be famous. And today it's almost like if you're famous because of some talents, it's not as valuable as if you're famous for the sake of being famous, you know? So I don't care why you have all these followers. If you have all these followers, you're amazing. Mm-hmm. And if you have all these followers and no apparent skill or hard work underpinning it, you're even more amazing, you know?
Right.
So I think those are the issues that maybe I'm just getting old and I sound like a grumpy old man, but I do think that there are also quite a few studies that show, for example, increases in narcissism and entitlement over the past 6 or 7 decades. In the United States, in the 1930s, a question or a statement that is used in clinical narcissism diagnosis, which is, I am destined to be famous, only 25 or 30% of respondents said yes. In the 50s, it was like 40%. In the 80s, it was 55%. Today, for people aged 20 to 30, 80% of people say yes, answer yes to the question or the statement, I am destined to be famous.
Wow.
The reality is they won't, you know, the vast majority won't. And so if you're, that's what we call entitlement, is very high aspirations, but without the work ethic and the talents to back them up. And if you have that gap, it creates a problem because then you're probably going to be unhappy and you're going to measure your worth by unrealistic and unfeasible markers, you know? Mm-hmm. Again, this goes back to entrepreneurship because there is also a glamorization of entrepreneurship, as the show Silicon Valley, you know, has highlighted, which is that if everyone believes that they can be the next Elon Musk or, you know, the next Steve Jobs, and because of that, they don't want to work and they are shying away from traditional employment and they think that they need to be college drop-offs, etc. You're going to end up with a lot of people who are disappointed, who could have contributed more to the economy and to society by other means. And sometimes the reality is they don't have the grit or the talents to back it up.
Right, right. One thing is about also being in a healthcare entrepreneurs, we don't often see a college dropout to start a company because being in a healthcare entrepreneur is really hard. I always say that, you know, there's so many stars in healthcare industry. They all have to be aligned, and yeah, it's so hard to align them. It's almost so. As a result, we see a lot of entrepreneurs who want to solve the healthcare problem are very passionate about trying to make an impact. What we're trying to help is like, how can we help them to achieve that? And I think leadership is so important to bring their technology to hit the patient.
And I think you also need technical expertise in healthcare, right? So you can't just improvise and say, hey, I have a great idea for, you know, for a new drug, a new treatment, a new methodology without having the expertise. So I think technical expertise is underrated as well, and it's essential. And you still get that mostly in good graduate, you know, or school kind of higher education qualifications.
Right. And I think what I also, you know, think sometimes when you're competent in the technical skill level, sometimes people overlook them because they're not, you know, performers, but they're so crucial into the success of your company. And I think as leaders, you need to be able to see that thing.
Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah. No, this is great. No, this is really fun. I think you provide so much insight and interest about how to look at confidence and how to be a better leader and be more disciplined, not just looking at things that's easy to spot, but really truly listen and observe, it seems.
Absolutely. It is the key. And, you know, just because something isn't easy doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And, you know, it's the world is increasing in complexity, and that clearly calls for more skills, more expertise. And, you know, you often hear people saying, oh, well, you know, it's too difficult now to know anything, so let's not bother and let's not try. No, that's not the answer. The answer is we have to work harder and develop more expertise.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.